know what to say. We make you feel so good. Now my dreams are wild, sometimes like a child. Dream I had everything, but wake up with nothing but a smile. But deep down inside, I kind of feel the way you smiling, girl, last night was for real.
Did you say my love was dynamite, dynamite, dynamite? Did you say I made you feel alright? Did you say my love was dynamite, dynamite, dynamite? Did you say we'd do it again tonight? Did you say my love was dynamite?
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
So, David, you do admit that UFOs exist. Well, what does UFO mean? It means unidentified flying object. It's different than intelligent alien species from another country. And yet another one of these UFOs has been shot down by the United States. Increasingly, the question is, what exactly are these? The latest claim is they are in the balloon category, generally similar to that first surveillance balloon believed to be from China that was shot down off the coast of South Carolina, but not exactly the same. And it is still early days and we are trying to gather information. So let's go to what we know and what took place. CNN reporting on Saturday, U.S. jet shoots down unidentified object over northern Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Saturday an unidentified object had been shot down by a U.S. fighter jet over Canadian airspace on his orders. I ordered the takedown of an unidentified object that violated Canadian airspace. NORAD command shot down the object over the Yukon. Canadian and U.S. aircraft were scrambled and a U.S. F-22 successfully fired at the object. The object is being described as cylindrical and smaller than the suspected Chinese balloon shot down last weekend, according to Canadian Defense Minister Anina Anand. Later Saturday, the White House confirmed Trudeau and Joe Biden authorized the shoot down, and the Pentagon said the object was first spotted over Alaska on Friday evening. Immediately, questions about was this the same thing or not? Was it in the category? Is balloon the right word? Here is what Senator Chuck Schumer said after being briefed by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
Until they get that comprehensive analysis, however, we have to look at each balloon individually.
Were these balloons Friday and Saturday night?
They believe they were, yes, but much smaller than the first one. Both of those, one over Canada, one over Alaska, were at 40,000 feet. Immediately, it was determined that that's a danger to commercial aircraft.
So there are sort of conspiracy types who are saying, wait a second, cylindrical object is very different than balloon. Everybody is lying to us. Right now, I have no reason in particular to think anybody is lying to us, but we do need more information, of course. We also have now been presented with the claim from China that the United States has done the exact same thing 10 times. There is a CNN article from this morning. China accuses U.S. of illegally flying balloons across its airspace. China has accused the U.S. of illegally flying high-altitude balloons into its airspace more than 10 times since January 2022, claims that drew an immediate rebuttal from the White House. We'll hear that rebuttal in a moment. As bilateral tensions flare in the fallout from the Chinese balloon that was shot down by American fighter jets after traveling across the continental U.S. Let's look at a clip here of the National Security Council's John Kirby, very clearly just denying that the U.S. does the same thing. Take a listen. And I believe we have the clip here. Do we have the clip? Let's see. I love having clips.
Beijing, just in the last hour or two, the foreign ministry there has accused the United States since the start of 2022 of flying balloons 10 different times over Chinese airspace. Can you respond to that accusation?
Not true. Not doing it. Just absolutely not true.
So the U.S., let me just push you a little further then. So the U.S. is not using these balloons technologies at all over China?
That is right. We are not flying balloons over China. That is absolutely true.
Now, understand, whenever such a statement is made, in colloquial language, we would say this is a complete denial. If you want to play these cynical games, which are very often accurate, right? I mean, we call them games, but there's a reason we play them. There's a couple critical words there, balloons and over China. His statement, and I hate that this is the way stuff is communicated these days. I am not arguing that such a thing is or isn't taking place. His statement is balloons aren't being flown over China. Could balloons be flown off the coast of China and he wouldn't be lying? Yeah. could there be something other than a balloon flown over China? And he wouldn't be lying. Yeah. So again, you always want to pay really close attention to the language that's being used. I'm not suggesting one thing or the other. We're just kind of parsing through it.
Okay. And then lastly, then, just as will that viewpoint be expressed directly to Beijing beyond here on the friendly confines of Morning Joe? When do the next conversations start between Washington and Beijing over a matter that's clearly inflaming tensions between the two countries?
Well, 2 points there, Jonathan. First of all, we still have diplomatic relations with China. We still have an embassy there. It's not like all communications between us and the PRC have shut down. Obviously, there are certain vehicles, like military-to-military vehicles, which are not open to us right now, and that's unfortunate. But we do have the ability to communicate directly with Chinese leaders, and we have.
Okay, so relations are still ongoing, although Kirby says we are absolutely not doing the same thing. So a couple different things going on here. Number one, do we want to, and should we figure out what exactly these unidentified flying objects are? Of course we should. Is it likely that at this point, official sources know more than they are saying publicly? Absolutely. Is it likely that the U.S. is doing equivalent surveillance in China to what China is doing in the U.S.? Of course, it might just take different forms. This is what countries do. It applies to Russia. It applies to many different countries. And lastly, at this time, do you have any reason to believe that these are intelligent aliens? We do not. And of course, I am mathematically and statistically open to the possibility of intelligent life out there in the universe. Do I believe it is these objects that represent that? I have no reason whatsoever to believe that that's the case. Solar power is suddenly awesome on Fox News now that these Chinese balloons are being asserted without evidence to have extraordinarily advanced solar power capabilities. This is so fun. These Fox News people are so predictable, and it's so funny in a way if it weren't so sad. Once again, Fox News propagandist Maria Bartiromo is starting to talk about solar panels. And in the context of the Chinese balloons, she again brought up, this is now the second weekend in a row that Maria brings up, they are getting unlimited power from these solar panels. They have unlimited energy. Wow. If now solar panels represent not some woke distraction from burning fossil fuels, but rather unlimited energy, seems like we should be taking solar more seriously in the U.S., don't you think? Here's Maria Bartiromo yesterday.
What is the CCP up to? Is this a test? And by the way, I've learned over the weekend that these balloons, the largest one that, you know, you could fit three buses in it that was shot down over South Carolina last Saturday, that balloon was able to snap images of our military installations and send them back to China in live time. So what John Ratcliffe told us last week was spot on. They were using solar panels for unlimited power, unlimited energy to continue the surveillance program.
Damn those solar panels. They're getting the best of us because they're so awesome. Unlimited power. It's crazy. What about clouds, like Trump said? What about nighttime, like Trump said? All of a sudden, solar power, the holy grail of surveillance and spying. And remember last weekend, she proposed something similar.
China, did it drop and disperse surveillance products powered by solar energy to allow unlimited surveillance?
Yeah, without any evidence whatsoever. Maria suggesting, you know, when Biden popped the balloon, it might have released micro surveillance elements powered by the sun, which could in perpetuity surveil the United States. Wow, it's amazing such technology even exists with solar power, Maria. So solar power sounds pretty damn awesome now if you watch Maria Bartiromo's program. According to Fox News, it sounds like solar energy is really the way to go. So, of course, we're sort of being tongue-in-cheek here, sort of being facetious. It would be great for them to just take solar panels and solar power 10% as seriously as they are taking it now in general, rather than doing their normal stuff. It's not sunny enough in the United States for solar, which would never work. Oh, but what about when it's cloudy out there? Blah, blah, blah. We just don't know. Just take it 10% as seriously as you're taking it now, and we would all be way better off. You truly cannot write this stuff. Another Republican. I'm not talking now about George Anthony DeVolder Santos. I'm talking about a different Republican who claimed Jewish heritage. And it turns out she's not only lying, Her grandfather was a Nazi. What a world that we live in. Article from the Jerusalem Post. Congresswoman claims to be Jewish, revealed to be the granddaughter of a Nazi. We are talking about new Republican Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna. She has claimed Jewish heritage previously, and it turns out her grandfather, Heinrich Mayerhofer, and this is not like a Jack Mayerhofer moment when Bill O'Reilly got pranked by that. This is genuinely the guy's name. Heinrich Mayerhofer, who died in 2003, served in the armed forces of Nazi Germany when he was a teenager in the 40s. You really should read this entire J Post article. It's wild, wild stuff. Florida Republican Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna was outed by The Washington Post Friday for lying about her Jewish heritage in a previous interview with The Jewish Insider. Not only is Luna almost certainly not Jewish, but according to several family members, according to The Post, Luna's paternal grandfather, Heinrich Mayerhofer, who died in 2003, served in the armed forces of Nazi Germany as a teenager in the 40s. Luna had told The Jewish Insider, "I was raised as a Messianic Jew by my father," clarifying she identifies as a Christian. "I am also a small fraction Ashkenazi." Now she's speaking ethnically, of course. The Insider had interviewed Luna in reaction to the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene, known for her Jewish space laser conspiracy, endorsed Luna's candidacy. "If she were anti-Semitic," asked Luna after claiming Ashkenazi roots, "why did she endorse me? I in no way, shape or form would ever put myself in a position where I'm hanging out with someone like that. And so I just don't see that Marjorie Taylor Greene is that person. If I see it happening on the right, I'm the first person to condemn it and say, like, hey, that's not cool. I don't align with that." Reminiscent of Hillary Clinton's, "I told Wall Street to cut it out," which they laughed about. But now this is taken seriously. Luna has also invoked Nazis in her political rhetoric. In 2021, she tweeted a video insinuating that a registry of Americans who were not vaccinated against COVID would be like the Nazi list of Jews. This is very, very quickly becoming another George Santos situation as the lies are piling up. Now, some people wrote to me and said, "David, you know, sure, she's a liar. But like, what's so bad about saying you're one religion when you're just not that religion? Like, David, if you said you were Baptist and you weren't Baptist, it wouldn't really be offensive. It would be a lie, but it would be offensive. It wouldn't be offensive. You really have to understand what Judaism is. Being Jewish is not just a religion. Judaism is a cultural identity. If you didn't convert into Judaism, you're also ethnically Jewish. Like when I did my DNA, it came back, oh, David, you're Ashkenazi. That's an ethnicity. I could change my beliefs into whatever, Mormonism. I'd still be ethnically Jewish. And there's a history, ethnically and culturally, in addition to religiously, which has faced centuries of persecution, really millennia. It's an ethno-religious group. And so when you falsely claim Jewish heritage, you're not only erasing the experiences and the struggles of actual Jewish people, you also perpetuate stereotypes, you're participating in cultural appropriation. So it's not like a harmless act. It is deception. It is a lie at the end of the day, but it's a particular type of lie that undermines trust and respect. So George Santos, George Anthony DeVolder Santos did this, falsely claiming Jewish heritage. Anna Paulina Luna has done it. And then lastly, there's one other wrinkle here. Pretending to be Jewish and then exonerating Marjorie Taylor Greene from accusations of anti-Semitism with your fake Jewishness is like another particularly disgusting layer to the entire thing. So it is not only Santos that is participating in these and many other lies. If you're curious about Luna's other lies, there's a number of articles about it now, which you can find. Ugly, ugly stuff. We're going to take a very quick break. Make sure you're subscribed to the YouTube channel. Make sure you're subscribed to the Spanish YouTube channel. What? David, what are you talking about? Later on in the show, I'll tell you all about what's going on in Spanish. There's something different about the David Pakman show as compared to many of the shows you might see from corporate media, which is that we are actually primarily funded by our audience, and we try to make it really easy for our audience to support us. You can make a pledge on Patreon. You can become a YouTube member. You can support us on Twitch during live streams, all these different ways. The best way, the simplest way, the most direct way where we keep the largest share of every dollar that is contributed is through our website memberships. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. The perks are straightforward. We do an extra show for all of our members, and you also get our daily show earlier and commercial free. And most recently, you also get a soundboard that mimics my soundboard.
Obama.
You know it.
Truth Central.
Pac-Man's a loser.
We have a soundboard like that available to our members. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. I look forward to welcoming you into the membership ranks. Well, folks, it's the Trump laptop. Yeah, it's, you know, with all of these things, it eventually comes back around and really bites Republicans. We are now aware of a laptop belonging to a Trump aide that contains on it classified documents. I know. But what about Hunter Biden? This is really unbelievable. CNN reports that the Trump team has turned over additional classified records and a laptop to federal prosecutors. Wow. The Trump attorneys also handed over an empty folder marked classified evening briefing. These are additional handovers, understand, still related to what took place in December and January. And it suggests, CNN writes, that the protracted effort by the Justice Department to repossess records from Trump's presidency may not be done. A Trump aide previously copied some pages of these classified documents onto a thumb drive and a laptop, not realizing they were classified, according to sources. The laptop, which belonged to an aide who works for Save America PAC, that's Trump's scam PAC, and the thumb drive were also given to investigators in January. Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation, which is pursuing criminal charges, possible criminal charges, subpoenaed Trump last May for all of this stuff. Folks, there's a laptop, okay? It is not surprising necessarily, but in a sense, it is still shocking that after year in, year out, Hillary's server, Hunter Biden's laptop, we now discover that Trump had people working for him involved in the mishandling of classified information, which we knew already, but now we even introduce a laptop element into it. We need that laptop. And former federal prosecutor Sean Wu was interviewed by Jim Acosta on CNN recently. He said that laptop's got to be a part of this investigation. Listen to this.
He turned over even more of these classified materials. A laptop has also come into the picture here to federal prosecutors in recent months.
It really underscores the enormous difference between what's going on with Biden's documents and Pence's. First of all, volume of documents, but the fact that they're still finding more and the fact that it's on a laptop is a huge security concern for that. So it really underscores why you really need a criminal investigation of that. Some questions in my mind still about why special counsel appointed for Biden and how come still don't have one for Pence.
And the laptop is a concern because, I mean, who knows what's
right
in there.
Yeah. Well, not only it's a concern that was downloaded, any classified information, sensitive information downloaded onto the laptop. From there, it's easily transmitted. It could be copied to other electronic devices as well. So that's very different than if you could say, hey, it's inside a room at least. We know where the document, the paper document was. But once it goes electronic, you can go anyplace.
Yeah. Now, there's another element to this as well. As I mentioned, the laptop belonged to someone who worked for the Save America PAC. Those aren't, in a sense, those aren't even political arms in the operational sense. We're talking about a PAC which just distributes money that is raised and figures out ways, in Trump's case, to funnel that money back into his friends and family and family members. So that is not even someone in the universe of people who even hypothetically should be reading classified documents. So the question we're quickly coming to, and I know many of you are frustrated and you've been sending me emails, when is Trump getting indicted, if at all? And I continue to say, I don't have any idea. You may all remember that for a period of years, I came to you and I was almost in tears, quite frankly, saying Trump's not going to be indicted. I don't expect any indictment whatsoever. And if he's indicted, he's not going to see a day of jail time or prison time. I admit that in the aftermath of the search warrant being executed at Mar-a-Lago, my view shifted as to the likelihood of an indictment. And I thought, oh, an indictment seems more likely at this point. But I still maintain that Trump is not going to see any jail time, any prison time, even in the most extreme hypothetical where Trump is convicted and sentenced. It would either be a suspended sentence or a sentence to be lived out at his home. And that is thinking so many years ahead, quite frankly. I am now going sort of back to where I was previously. I just don't know that an indictment is coming. I really don't. And ultimately, if either way, whatever consequences there are going to be minor and symbolic in nature, does it even matter? I do think it matters. I actually think indicting a former president would be a big, big deal. It also could really throw the campaign into further disarray, which would be great to see. And we'll talk about how that campaign is going a little later. But I share the frustration. I don't know that an indictment is actually coming. At the same time, Trump might be indicted tomorrow. It's extraordinarily unclear. And in addition to that, there are so many different investigations which could lead to an indictment that it's very hard to know what's going on. I think the best approach is wait and see, live your life. And if Trump's indicted, we will all know and we will assess from there. I have something really good to show you. Dan Goldman is a new congressman on the Democratic side. This guy is a major asset to the Democratic Party. He confronted Republican Congressman Jim Jordan during this weaponization committee. Republicans, when they took control of the House, created all of these bogus committees. We're going to do a Twitter committee to look into big tech. We're going to do a weaponization of government committee to look into the FBI and all these different things. Jim Jordan, during these hearings, has offhandedly been mentioning that there are dozens of whistleblowers who know the truth about what went on. Dan Goldman, who's an attorney, actually confronts Jim Jordan and says, are there notes about these whistleblowers? When will you give us the information about these whistleblowers? And look at how quickly and easily Jim Jordan is tangled up into a rhetorical pretzel. This is so devastating. The way that Goldman schools Jordan here is brutal. And I don't know why Jordan would have expected anything else from a former federal prosecutor, an actual prosecutor. Let's dive right into this. This is gold.
On providing that to the minority.
The point is, it wasn't special so much, it became the norm. With that, the chair now recognized.
Can I have a point of order? There's been a lot of mention of information and testimony that you all have received from whistleblowers. When are you planning on providing that to the minority?
You could have been for the very first deposition, or excuse me, transcribed interview of the whistleblower. I was there when he testified on Tuesday.
That's fine. I assume you'll turn those over. But what about you talk about dozens of whistleblowers. When are we going to get that information?
Remember, dozens means at least 24. You're talking about at least two dozen.
When they testify, I'll work with the ranking member on that.
You don't have any transcriptions of their interviews?
We have the first one, and we have the dozens who've come and talked to our office.
They talked to your office privately?
They talked to Republican staff, right.
And they're not transcribed, no notes, no nothing?
The first one happened Tuesday.
No, I'm not talking about the first one.
The first one happened Tuesday. The next one happens tomorrow. The third one happens next Wednesday. And we'll continue to do that.
You just said dozens. Do you have notes from those? Or they're just talking to you?
At the rate at which Jordan's saying they're going to be talking to people, you're talking about a year before you hear from dozens.
Chairman, isn't that how whistleblowers typically work?
Well, it's how they're supposed to work. It's not how they worked in the impeachment that Mr. Goldman was a part of when
ad goes into ad hominems.
Mr. Schiff said he didn't have contact with that whistleblower, but in fact,
it worked exactly appropriately until Mr. Trump would not allow.
We're doing it the way we're supposed to do it, Mr. Goldman.
No, you're supposed to turn it over to the minority.
When they come and testify, you'll have access to the transcript.
And understand what Jordan. So the point that Goldman is making is inquiring as to whether these dozens of whistleblowers really exist, because they keep being mentioned in passing. And what Jordan wants to focus on is you'll hear from them when they come and testify. But of course, both sides have people on the committee. Both sides get to ask witnesses questions. In order for the Democrats on the committee to be ready to meaningfully inquire of these supposedly dozens of whistleblowers, they need information about them. They don't even have names. Understand that. And that'll be mentioned in a moment. Jim Jordan keeps saying, well, you'll get information when they testify. And Goldman says, but where are the notes? Where's the information so we can prepare? The implication, of course, is these dozens of whistleblowers simply don't exist.
Everyone on the committee will.
You mean your staff is not going to turn it over to our staff? We're just in the dark?
No, when the transcript is done, you will get the transcript.
I mean of the dozens of whistleblowers you have already talked to that came to talk to your staff.
Supposedly.
Yeah, what do you want me to turn over there?
Jim, are the whistleblowers in the room with us right now? Can you see them here?
Their names?
Notes? Did anyone take notes?
I'll be happy to talk with the ranking member on how we handle that information.
Thank you.
All I'm telling you is we will schedule each for a deposition and we're...
That is not what he's talking about.
Doing that. You didn't show up for the first one, but you could have been there. With that,
I didn't know about it.
The chair now recognizes...
Goldman's a really valuable asset in this political climate. He is straightforward in his approach, but he maintains a professional demeanor. He has extraordinary attention to detail. He leaves no stone unturned in his lines of inquiry. And we all know the implication here, which is there is no evidence that these dozens of whistleblowers exist. We're aware of one supposed whistleblower. Remember also that the right has a history over the last, let's call it in the Trump era, in the last 6+ years. The right has a history of presenting someone as a whistleblower when they're not really blowing the whistle about anything. Like, I could call myself a whistleblower, but then if I show up and I basically say, here's the terms of service from Twitter and they were being followed, I'm not really blowing the whistle on anything, right? You can call me a whistleblower. You can turn on bright lights and put makeup on me and ask me questions and say I'm a hero and put me on Hannity or whatever. But I'm not really blowing the whistle unless I'm actually blowing the whistle. And so do these 24 or 36, I don't know how many dozens Jim Jordan, maybe, I don't know if Jim Jordan knows what the word dozens mean, but if these dozens of whistleblowers exist is a real question. And if people exist who are going to be called whistleblowers, there's a real question as to whether they are blowing the whistle about anything. So Jim Jordan is not the type of guy that can go up against Dan Goldman. Jim Jordan should be embarrassed in this way at every single hearing because he is a joke and it is humiliating. We'll have the clips I played for you here on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show, and on our YouTube channel. Search YouTube for David Pakman Show. You'll find it easily. There is an absolutely brutal new poll in which Donald Trump is losing to Ron DeSantis by 13 in the 2024 Republican primary. Let's talk about it. But wait, what you like trust polls, man, or what? Remember that moment from my interview with Patrick Bet David in Florida a couple weeks ago? Well, listen, I mean, let's talk about it, right? When we look at polls, there are three important questions that we ask. Is the pollster highly rated and historically reliable? That's an important question. Second question, is this one poll dramatically different than every other poll? If you have 20 polls, 19 say one thing and one says something else, we would want to understand why that is. And is there something in particular about the subject matter or the timing that makes polling on a particular issue inherently unreliable? So it's not about pollster quality. It's just about this is a really hard thing or it's a really hard time to be asking people about this subject matter. So let's ask that question. OK, a new Monmouth poll has Donald Trump losing to Ron DeSantis, who is not even running yet, by 13 points in a hypothetical Republican primary. That's 53 for DeSantis to 40 for Trump. Now, that is a hypothetical head-to-head. If you end up having Nikki Haley run, she's expected to announce soon. If you've got Mike Pompeo, Mike Pence, maybe other people named Mike, or maybe some people not named Mike, you are going to have different numbers. This is a hypothetical head-to-head. Now, let's run through our questions. Is Monmouth a good pollster? The answer is yes. Monmouth is an A-rated pollster by 538. Even Morning Consult, which is often used by corporate media, it's only a B-rated pollster. YouGov Yahoo poll, which is very much used as well, is a B+. So yes, our first question, Monmouth is a good pollster. Is this poll an outlier compared to others? In a sense, it is. OK, and so we can look at 538's recent Republican primary polls and the results are sort of off the map, not off the map. The results are all over the map. And so depending on where you look, There's a primary poll from The Economist from a few days ago. That one has Trump plus 10, but there's a lot of undecideds there. You look at a YouGov poll. It has Trump up 2 in Trump versus DeSantis. You look at a Morning Consult poll from about a week ago, and that one has Trump plus 18. So in a sense, yes, the Monmouth poll is a little bit of an outlier, although you can find polling here that does have DeSantis leading. There's a YouGov Yahoo News poll which has DeSantis plus 4 when it's asked in a different way without other candidates head to head. So the general answer to is this an outlier is when the polling is Trump versus DeSantis only, it does seem to be pretty good for Ron DeSantis. When the polling includes other candidates or it doesn't force an answer and lets you put, I don't know, haven't decided yet or whatever, then it seems to be better for Donald Trump. And then we get to the third question I mentioned. Is this something we can even really get good data on in February of the year before the election? Yes and no. You know, valuable polling data without a clear field, unclear about whether Trump is going to get indicted, unclear what Joe Biden's next 2 years are going to look like and what Republicans are going to run on and what voters are going to want. There is a limit to how valuable today's polling data is. It doesn't mean the polling is inaccurate based on what Republican voters are saying right now. It's a broader question, which is, does this type of poll, 9 plus 12, 21 months before an election, well, and in this particular case, more like 17 months before the primary, is going to be of some limited value. What this polling will do is it will brutally trigger Donald Trump and possibly explode this feud civil war that is building between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Donald Trump is still in the business of throwing childish tantrums, this time unleashing the most pathetic attack so far on Florida governor, Trump's governor. Remember, Trump lives in Florida, on his own governor, Ron DeSantis. Donald Trump, desperate to find new ways to attack a guy who is defeating Trump in some polls, despite the fact that Ron DeSantis hasn't even said, I'm running for this thing. He's not even a candidate. And he is ahead of Trump significantly in some polls, including the most recent Monmouth poll. This genuinely has the potential to put the 2016 Republican Party to shame in terms of how humiliating and absurd this primary could be. Donald Trump, on the heels of this new Monmouth poll that has DeSantis beating him by 13, which we already talked about, has posted an attack on Ron DeSantis to his platform, Truth Social.
Truth Central.
In which he goes after Ron DeSantis for wearing a blue tie when he met with Trump in the Oval Office while Trump was president. Well, not exactly. Let's take a look at the post from Truth Social. Trump posting a picture where he is sitting there with Matt Gaetz and DeSantis. I forget who the guy is on the right. I feel so silly, but I forget who that is. And Ron DeSantis is wearing a blue tie. And Donald Trump says in his post, who is that in the blue tie being so nice to the president of the United States while in the Oval Office? Now, this is not actually about the tie color. This is about Trump pointing out, Ron DeSantis, who now says bad things about me, used to suck up to me. Now, of course, to all of us who understand how politics works, we understand that that's how politics works. You try to get close to power. If you're someone like Ron DeSantis, you want to go to the White House. Governors love going to the White House. So, of course, you're nice to Trump. But Trump simply can't help but try to find anything to attack DeSantis over. Recall that last week he went after DeSantis for this picture in which DeSantis is with some allegedly high school aged girls who I guess he was teaching. He was the teacher of. And Trump posted, that's not Ron, is it? He would never do such a thing, referring to grooming high school girls with alcohol. Yeah. Meanwhile, in addition, Trump adding to the embarrassment by tweeting trash polls in response to the Monmouth poll, which has Trump down 13. Trump tweeting about a premise poll If you haven't heard of Premise as a pollster, they're not even serious enough to be rated by 538. That one has Trump up 30 points. That seems a little bit difficult to believe. And Trump also posting a link to a Breitbart poll, which isn't even a poll. It's just a favorability poll. It's not an actual 2024 poll. It is all completely pathetic. And this is going to be an insane primary. Now, I want to, I've been wanting to do this for a little bit. I want to kind of frame the next 21 months for you. If you have read Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, I know many of you were thinking, David, you're not going to quote Technopoly again, are you? No, this is an earlier book by Neil Postman. It's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Postman wrote this book in the mid-80s. I think it was in 85. And what Postman argued was that if we're going to do a serious analysis of television, and remember, in the mid-80s, things were moving from sort of a print medium dramatically more towards a visual medium, television. One of the things that Neil Postman talked about is it's not just about the content of television. It's about the fact that television frames all issues as having to be or needing to be entertaining. Sesame Street, which is a great program, right? Sesame Street still implicitly is telling us learning should be entertaining. And it devalues more difficult forms of learning that aren't entertaining, but require a different type of thought. And one of the things that has become true, not only in the era of television, but you could take Neil Postman's 85 analysis and make it in 2023 when it comes to social and online media. One of the things that has become a reality is that there is this expectation that the format of how we get news today, Twitter and the way TV news is produced and online news as well. Okay, I'm part of this. We now believe politics should also be entertaining. Debates should be entertaining. And that's why primary debates and presidential debates have these 1 minute answers and 30 second rebuttals, 15 second rebuttals. It's not to actually learn anything about the candidates. In fact, it prevents us from learning about the candidates. There are other ways to learn about the candidates. It tells us politics should be entertaining. These things should be entertaining. And so in a sense, I am part of this. My goal is to work within the formats that are available to reach as many people as possible and tell them, hey, there are better ways to think through who we're going to vote for and learn. Okay, so what's the point of me telling you this? One of the things that we really have to think about as we go from now into the primaries and into the general election is that to really figure out who we should be voting for, what policies would be better for the country, all these different things, you have to exit the world of where it all needs to be entertaining. The unfortunate reality is, and we're going to talk about the strategy later or probably tomorrow, in order to defeat Trump, and this is the point I'm building to, in order to defeat Trump, Ron DeSantis has to do some of the things Trump does well. He has to be entertaining. He has to attack Trump. He has to be titillating and salacious. And Ron DeSantis is going to have to figure out how. It is a horrible thing that on the one hand, we know that all of this is terrible for the country. The fact that this is how a Republican primary is going to be fought, who can come up with the slickest insults in the entire thing? I would love to change that. I can't change that. And so when we are thinking through how Republicans are going to choose their nominee, Democrats to a degree, the same thing. But if Biden runs, they're not really going to be choosing. It's going to be Biden. It's going to come down to who can make their campaign as entertaining and titillating as possible. Not who can propose the best policy on healthcare. Not who can lay out the most sober and sensible foreign policy. It doesn't make a difference. What matters is, can you compartmentalize it, make it a snippet, and make it as entertaining as possible? And that is how politics is done. And it's a sad and horrible thing. And we're going to be looking at this election through that lens. I'm going to do everything I can to really try to do that because I think it has to be done. All right, let's take a quick break. We have many other things to talk about coming up in mere moments. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you today exciting news of medical advancement. We now have seen an individual healed from his paralysis merely through the prayer of a Christian preacher. This now will allow us to heal so many people. I never knew it was so simple. Take a look at this incredible video of a Christian preacher restoring the movement and feeling in a man's paralyzed hand. And he did it on a stage with music playing, if you can imagine.
This is John.
Okay.
He's an electrician. Four years ago, he was in a work accident where he got completely shocked. He lost feeling in his left hand. He said, today, when you called it out earlier, someone has numbness. He said he started feeling a tingling sensation in his left hand. And in prayer, he said he started moving his hand in faith. He now has mobility and feeling in his left hand.
Wow. It's been a long time. It's starting to do it. I feel a tingling. I think it needs more because these fingers are not going straight yet, but I got a lot more movement.
Let's pray complete miracle tonight in Jesus' name. Pray, pray, pray. Let this miracle be done.
Folks, pray harder.
In the name of Jesus. Look at that. Do it again. That's it. Are you seeing this? Lord, touch him with your power. Let this miracle come to pass.
The guy now has fainted.
Lord, give him that grace and ability.
But his hand is moving perfectly, even though the guy is unconscious.
To close that hand even now. In the name of Jesus. Pick him up for a second. How shaken up about this are you right now?
I'm tingling like I just got electrocuted again.
What is that? Was that the wrong hand there?
Well, this electricity's good, my brother. This one's good. Look at that again. Oh, my goodness. Can we give Jesus a mighty hand of praise?
Remember, it's not the preacher. It's Jesus that's doing it. I genuinely hate this stuff. Now, sometimes the person being healed is a part of the scam. And sometimes the person being healed is sort of a victim. And we've seen every scenario with this, okay? Sometimes it's an individual who was never actually paralyzed, for example. Sometimes what can happen is there's sort of like a surge of energy. There's like an endorphin release. And you might temporarily think you're healed. You know, there's often like the ones who, I haven't walked in 40 years. And then they stand up and they push their cane away or their walker or whatever. And then it turns out they weren't really healed. They had like a you know, just a surge of energy and they could have briefly stood at any point. But it doesn't mean that now they can walk or anything like that. But sometimes the person being healed is just out and out part of the scam. And it's all a lie, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I continue to say, show me a single faith healer who can regrow the amputated limb of an individual. That would be something that is much less ambiguous, although you could probably make a scam with that too, right? I mean, David Copperfield makes it look like he splits people in half. So you probably could make someone look like they're missing a limb and then it grows back or whatever. But you understand what I'm saying. Do something like that. And then we might be able to talk about it. But this goes back a very long time. Preachers who claim to have cured people of afflictions. And it's a rowdy sort of revival style crowd. And sometimes people from the crowd are called out. Sometimes symptoms are called out and people volunteer themselves. And again, you don't know if they're victims or if they're scammers or whatever the case may be. And sometimes there's a physical laying of hands on them. Sometimes there isn't. We've seen fake surgery. We've seen all of this stuff. And of course, there's no evidence that any of it is miraculous. And again, we could test this. We really could. You know, I'm going to tell you the way it could be done. And we all know that these faith healers would never subject themselves to it. But if you really wanted to do this, you could go to the faith healers. You could go, okay, listen, let's make it fair. Give me the list of conditions you could cure, that you could heal. None of them would say I can regrow an amputated limb. That would never be there. They would go, well, I can cure problems of the stomach, you know, stomach pains I can cure and headaches. And tingling, numb, whatever. Get the list from them of the stuff, and then you do a controlled experiment. And then, of course, we all know if any of these folks could really do this stuff, it would be immediately praised by the medical community. It would be studied and praised if it was determined to be real. Now, I know many of you will say, David, the Western medical community would never acknowledge faith healing, because if faith healing were real, they would be out of a job. You wouldn't need doctors anymore if faith healing were real. Okay, yeah, I understand the motivation claim that you're making, but the medical science community studies everything. You know, people like to say, we've never studied the effect of giving people high doses of niacin for depression. Actually, we have studied that. There's many studies about that. And I guarantee you, especially the medical researchers that are not part of Big Pharma, would be glad to evaluate and study this. And we would all know if it were actually a real thing, but they never subject themselves to it. So this can be dangerous in that some people accept it as an alternative to seeking real medical treatment. It's often fraudulent. It often is weaponized against people with little financial means. So they're there in the first place, maybe because they can pay $40 to go into the revival tent, rather than what it might cost for real treatment. And that's a problem with the medical system, of course, which we've talked about. But let's rely on evidence-based medicine. I don't know what else to tell you, but this is truly horrible stuff. Folks, the Spanish channel is now live. The Spanish channel is now live. We have launched the David Pakman Show in Spanish, or we might call it The David Pakman Show en Español. You can find this new channel at YouTube. Now, listen very carefully here, okay? Because URLs can't contain that little that goes above the N in some Spanish words. So you go to youtube.com/@ David Pakman Español, not Español. Espanol. Okay, I know it's the best we could do with the URL. This channel is our next project to reach Spanish speaking American residents. Of course, everyone is free to watch. One of the things I hear all the time and experienced personally when I did the Spanish show around the time of the 2020 election is that there is a dearth of progressive opinion content in Spanish about American politics. Yeah. In Argentina, you can find 1,000 shows about Argentinian politics. In Mexico, you can find 1,000 shows about Mexican politics. But so many of you write to me and say, David, I'm first generation, second generation, whatever. I like watching news and politics in English. My parents like watching in Spanish. We need something like the David Pakman Show in Spanish. The right has tons of Spanish language talk radio spreading conspiracy theories about everything from vaccines to Jews and everything in between. Okay. So the reason we're doing this, and it's not cheap, is because it is necessary. It is necessary to do it. So tell people who prefer to consume content in Spanish that this is now available. youtube.com/@DavidPakman ESPANOL. Okay. If you want to help us just by subscribing as well, even if you're not looking for the Spanish stuff, great. We are under 1,000 subscribers on this, but I think that this could be absolutely huge. And remember that we do fund this entire project. We have to pay for the dubbing. Okay. We have to pay for that up front. And it's at a loss because obviously the channel is just starting. The David Pakman Show memberships do fund all of the stuff that we're doing, including this new Spanish project, which I think is just so important and could be so important to actually electing progressive candidates. We need to be reaching the Spanish speaking audience. And it's an amazing thing to be doing. So super, super exciting. Now, one thing I will mention, people have already started to write to me and they say, David, you speak Spanish. You should be just doing this, all of the segments over again in Spanish. I can't do it. Okay. I'm out of time for the day. I just do not have the time between all of my current responsibilities, filming the show, working with our team to get everything out, short form content, live streams, running the business, the baby at home, all these different things. I can't also now start doing my show in Spanish. So I know there are people who would rather me do the Spanish language stuff. It exceeds the number of hours in the day. So that is not going to be part of the plan. But I think this is a really great thing. Let's do it. Let's check it out. Let me know what you think. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. A few people contacted me about the Circuit City stuff that came up during my interview a couple weeks ago with Patrick Bet-David. Here's one such voicemail.
Hey, David, I saw you on Patrick Bet-David's podcast.
Yes.
And I know you brought up how you sold the extended service plans at Circuit City. And I just wanted to hear the story. It sounded like you wanted to tell it, and he didn't really give you a chance. So I was curious. Thanks.
Well, you know, it's not really one story, but it was absolutely, you know, I've said before when I worked at Circuit City when I was in high school, it really allowed me to develop really important interpersonal skills for quickly building rapport, establishing a connection with people, getting right to the crux of whatever it was that brought people into the store that day. It really invaluable skills that I'm so grateful, even if Circuit City ultimately laid me off because they laid off everybody who was selling too much stuff because they didn't want to pay us when they switched from commission to hourly. But one of the most interesting aspects of it was the selling of extended service plans. And I've said before that at Circuit City, if you were reliably selling these service plans, you could make half to 60% of your income from the service plans rather than the products themselves. It wasn't uncommon. I'm going back a ways now, but just roughly, it was, and think about inflation. This was 20 years ago. It wasn't uncommon that if you sold a computer, you might make $18 in commission, but the warranty associated with it would pay you $40 if the customer bought it. And we had all sorts of interesting techniques and ideas, and everybody always tried to be creative but honest in order to sell those service plans. And we were not incentivized to lie, because if there was a problem, the people would come back, that service plan would be refunded, and you would lose the commission. So there really was not an incentive to lie. One of the things I would often do is I would introduce the idea of the fact that sometimes things break and it's better to be able to come back to the store than to have to ship it to, you know, Hewlett Packard or whatever. I would introduce it early in the process, and that made it so that it sort of sold itself. So people would come in, you know, they might be looking for a laptop. I'd say, oh, well, why are you looking for the laptop? Mine crapped out. Really? How old was it? 3 years. Really? And did you have an extended service plan on it? No, I didn't. Oh, you know, if you did, it might be covered. You might just be able to get it fixed. That was my approach. I wasn't coming up with any, you know, confrontational techniques to start begging people to buy warranties. I would just introduce it early. And by the time we would get to the sales point, I would say, by the way, I mentioned earlier that if you had a service plan on your current laptop, you might not even need to get a new one right now. It's a relatively small amount of money given how expensive computer repairs are right now. And, you know, at the time it was much harder to work on laptops than it is now. So many of the parts were self-contained and proprietary. Here's what it is. And it really was that simple. You know, there was no big mystery to it, but it really was about establishing the rapport and building the relationship with people. Anyway, it was a fascinating time and invaluable in terms of the skills that I learned there. And sadly, Circuit City decided, no more commission. We see Best Buy paying people $7 an hour. Let's switch everybody to hourly. And then within months was out of business. Maybe 18 months or something along those lines. So apparently the wrong decision. So that was the Circuit City story. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money.
Yes.
Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Let's make some money, Alex. Let's do it. We are going to talk about the reports that Nikki Haley is reportedly about to announce she's running for president in 2024, becoming the first what we might call major competitor to Donald Trump. Trump is going to lose his mind. Trump and Haley were friendly during Trump's presidency, but this is going to trigger Trump, and it's going to be very interesting. We'll discuss that. Secondly, Alabama Democrats want to ban employers from being able to force workers to get microchipped. Why is this even coming up? I will tell you. And lastly, the College Board is slamming DeSantis's Florida for what it is calling slander of the advanced placement Black History course that has been the subject of so much controversy over the last few weeks. All of those stories and more when I am joined by producer Pat on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Don't miss it because it is going to be a beautiful bonus show. I will see you then. A new anti-woke hero has surfaced for many on the anti-trans right. His name is Senator Matt McKee. He is a state senator in Arkansas. He did the heroic thing where he asked a trans pharmacist whether she has a penis. And this makes you a hero among much of the anti-trans right. Let me set this up for you before we play the clip. And the clip is quite stunning. Arkansas has been on this warpath to do things that really aren't worth doing in order to virtue signal. Like, for example, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders signing a law banning critical race theory being taught in public schools, which, of course, it's not being taught in public schools, so it doesn't really matter. OK, Arkansas also is on this path to criminalize gender affirming care, medical care we're talking about. And this is part of the battle against trans people. And there was an almost surreal moment during which Republican State Senator Matt McKee asked a trans pharmacist, Gwendolyn Herzig, whether she has a penis. Now, the bill that was being discussed eventually passed on Monday morning with only one Democrat at the meeting voting against it. This is Senate Bill 199 to open up doctors who provide gender affirming care to youth. Significant loopholes and additional malpractice liabilities and all sorts of different things in order to make it more difficult to provide that care. And so a pharmacist named Gwendolyn Herzig, who is a trans Arkansan, spoke against the bill, spoke against SB 199, shared her experience as a trans person and healthcare provider in the state of Arkansas. She did not receive much respect, but she was asked, "Do you have a penis?" Take a listen to this.
You said that you're a trans woman.
I trans female, yes, ma'am, sir.
Do you have a penis?
That's horrible.
Yeah. You're the one that brought that into the discussion.
Yeah. Really on the vanguard of political philosophy and medical treatment, as you can see here. Do you have a penis? I would turn it around on this guy and say, sir, I know you're a dick, but do you have a penis? The obsession with other people's genitalia is really something. The anti-trans people consider that heroic. They think that's a massive anti-woke victory to really ask the questions that need asking. It's biology and truth or whatever it is, right?
Globalist, internationalist.
Yeah, you know the stuff. I hate to say it, folks. I really do. I would get out of Arkansas. And the reason I hate to say it is most people can't just easily move to another state. That it's just a reality, either for financial reasons, because you're established in a certain state, your job's not mobile, your family's not mobile, everyone you know is in a particular place. So, you know, my instinct is always to say, work within the system and figure out how to improve things and lobby and all these different things. Arkansas is becoming so backwards. We've looked at the healthcare numbers near the bottom. We've looked at the crime numbers near the worst in the country. We've looked at the education numbers. We've looked at the infrastructure numbers. Arkansas is not a great place to be. And I'm sure Little Rock has beautiful cafes and you can get a great cappuccino and maybe even a bagel. But it's really going in a bad direction now under the stewardship, if you can call it that, of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, wasting resources and money and time on meaningless things. The openly anti-trans attacks that are going on. I don't know at this point that it's the sort of thing where, listen, if you're in the position to say, I can deal with a horrible place for 10 years because I want to make it better through activism, I'm with you. I'm with you. But for so many people at this point, it has become so disastrous in that state that it may be time to leave. And that's a really difficult thing to do in a lot of different ways, but it has gotten disastrously bad in Arkansas. Do you have a penis, the latest in the battle lines against the wokesters or whatever it is they call it? They see this as a victory. We see it as humiliating. A lying Republican now says that when you call out her lies.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again. Then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2.
I am, and I think the administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea.
As the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine approaches, we look at one of the great mysteries of the past year. Who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline connecting Russia to Germany? We'll speak with legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh. He exposed the My Lai massacre and Abu Ghraib. His latest article is headlined, How America Took Out the Nord Stream Pipeline. Then we go to Michigan, where vigils were held Tuesday night to remember the three Michigan State University students killed in yet another mass shooting.
We're all broken by an all too familiar feeling. Another place that is supposed to be about community and togetherness, shattered by bullets and bloodshed. We know this is a uniquely American problem.
Since the beginning of this year, on average, there have been more than one mass shooting a day in the United States. We'll go to Michigan to speak with an MSU professor and also talk to a gun control activist who lost his sister in the Parkland High School massacre 5 years ago this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A convoy of UN aid trucks passed through a newly reopened border crossing into northwestern Syria Tuesday, where some earthquake survivors have been waiting for help for over a week. In Turkey, 9 survivors were pulled from the wreckage Tuesday as the death toll from last Monday's 7.8 magnitude earthquake and aftershocks topped 41,000 across Turkey and Syria. The World Health Organization warned of the risk of waterborne diseases amidst the massive destruction and displacement in both countries. Medical workers also report many patients with mental health concerns, including PTSD. This is Diana Fatal, a UNICEF worker in Syria.
Thousands of children faced on the 6th of February a crisis within a crisis where they continue to face complex situation of displacement, of fear, and extreme cold weather. As you see that this collective shelter that used to be a school is now accommodating families that lost houses and loved ones.
The United Nations says it needs $5.6 billion to help address the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine and to help the millions who fled Ukraine since Russia's invasion began almost a year ago. The UN estimates nearly 22 million Ukrainians depend on humanitarian assistance. This comes as NATO says Russia's eastern offensive has begun as Moscow aims to capture the strategic city of Bakhmut. The Ukrainian military ordered aid groups to leave the city earlier this week. Kyiv says, though, it has repelled Russian attacks on Luhansk. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is seeking to restart a program to place U.S. Special Operations Forces inside Ukraine. In other news on the war, a State Department-backed report has accused Russia of holding at least 6,000 Ukrainian children at facilities in occupied Crimea and Russia. State Department spokesperson Ned Price criticized the Russia program on Tuesday.
Putin seeks to rob Ukraine of its future by taking its children.
Russia's system of forced relocation, re-education, and adoption of Ukraine's children is a key element of the Kremlin's systematic efforts to deny and suppress Ukraine's identity, its history, and its culture.
An Israeli